Over the past 10 years, several best-selling books have been written about Elizabeth Smart, who was just 14 years old when she was abducted at knife point from her family's Salt Lake City home in 2002 and then held for 9 months. But until now, Ms. Smart has kept many of the details of her ordeal to herself. That changed when she decided to write a memoir, which she's called simply My Story. The book, written with Chris Stewart, is just out from St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Elizabeth Smart to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I have the impression that you're a fairly private person and that you've been reluctant to talk publicly about the abuse that you suffered at the hands of your kidnappers. So what's inspired you to do this now?
There's been a lot of reasons, really, but I think the main reason is that I do quite a bit of public speaking, and every time I've gone out and spoken, without fail, there's always at least one person who comes up to me and tells me they were raped or suffered some kind of sexual abuse, and it makes me sick to hear that. I hate hearing that, and it's just so much more widespread than any of us realize.
Because a lot of people are afraid to even report it, and as you point
afraid,
out in the
embarrassed.
Book, there's still a lot of shame associated with rape in many people's minds. So
yes.
you're hoping to...
So I'm hoping to reach out to them and to let them know that it's okay, that these things do happen, but that doesn't make you any less of a person, and that you can move forward, that you can learn to be happy again and be the kind of person you want to be.
Well, a lot of people are affected emotionally. Were you surprised when an interviewer on the Today Show yesterday began crying during the interview?
It was very, very touching. Very, very, I mean, I just felt she was so sweet.
Mm-hmm. Well, people can definitely associate. As you point out, rape is more common than anybody, than the statistics would indicate. And that also suggests that most people know somebody who's been raped or they've been raped themselves.
Well, 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused before they're 18. I mean, that makes people in this office, someone in this office, at least one person in this office, a victim of sexual abuse.
You created a foundation called the Elizabeth Smart Foundation that works to fight against sexual violence against children?
We work to give children options. We work with a program called RAD Kids. RAD stands for Resisting Aggression Offensively, and it's all about empowering the child, letting them know that they can do something, that they do have a choice. When they're put in an impossible situation, they can fight back, they can do whatever it takes to get away, and that, heaven forbid, something does happen, but if it does happen, that they can tell someone that it's not their fault, that they can do something about it.
You said that your mother said something that inspired you and helped you to move forward after you were rescued. Do you remember what she told you?
My mom, she's always been my hero. And she said, "What this man has done to you, Elizabeth, is terrible. There aren't words strong enough to describe how wicked and evil he is. He has taken 9 months of your life from you that you will never get back. The best punishment you could ever give him is to be happy, is to move forward and not give him another second of your life."
And they say, there's that old saying, living well is the best revenge.
Well, that's true.
But it's not always so easy to find joy in a life after you've been through a traumatic experience. Because I'm sure you have replayed some of this story again and again in your mind.
Well, everybody's path to life and healing is different. And for me, when I was kidnapped, I felt like everything I knew and loved had been ripped away from me. I felt like my life had been stolen. And so when I was rescued, I was so happy and I was so, so grateful because I felt like it all had been given back to me. I mean, maybe as silly as it sounds, I felt grateful because I'd have the chance to go back to school. I'd have the chance to date boys, have a boyfriend, get dumped. I mean, I'd have a chance to get married, have a family. Everything that I felt had been stolen from me.
And for a while, you thought that you were going to be in that situation for a very long time. You say that one of your only consolations was you realized that you were much younger than your kidnappers, so they were going to die before you died.
Yeah. I mean, he had successfully kidnapped me, had successfully hidden me, and I watched people come up to us and turn around and walk away. And I felt like nobody would ever rescue me. I felt like the odds were just against me, but I was determined to survive. And so I felt like, yeah, outliving them would be the best option.
When those people came up to you and then walked away, do you think any of them understood that you were Elizabeth Smart? Or was it just they saw this strange group of people?
I think they came up with curiosity about us, about me. I think there were definitely people who wondered. But by the time they turned around, this is just how manipulative and deceiving Mitchell is. I mean, he's very, very good at what he does. He had them fully convinced by the time they went away that I wasn't me.
You've said that after you returned home, you didn't seek professional counseling to deal with the trauma you'd suffered. Did you and your family feel that that wasn't the right choice for you, or is it?
My parents have always been very open and very supportive and telling me they will help me do whatever I want to do. I can have any kind of counseling I want, and I'd really like to take this opportunity because there isn't a right way. There isn't a wrong way to healing. Everybody has the right to their own pathway. And for me, I don't think to myself, well, I've never had therapy. I wouldn't say that because I believe there are many different kinds of therapy. And for me, my music has been very therapeutic.
You play the harp?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I started when I was 5, and it's always been a part of my life. And I've always felt that through music, you can say things that you can't say with words.
My guest is Elizabeth Smart, who with Chris Stewart has written a memoir called My Story. It's published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You were married last year.
Yes.
To Matthew Gilmore, who's from Scotland.
Yes.
And there was a gorgeous photo of you in a wedding dress on the cover of People magazine. I'm sure you never imagined
that
you'd ever be on the cover of People or even Inside.
No, I never did.
Didn't you and Matthew meet while you were doing Mormon missionary work in France?
We did.
He told you that he hadn't heard about your ordeal before he met you. Was that a relief?
It was refreshing because I never had to wonder whether or not he liked me because he wanted attention or because he genuinely liked me. I always knew he genuinely liked me.
I'm assuming that you get kind of tired of strangers knowing or thinking that they know all about you because of all of the publicity and attention that your case received.
It's definitely been an adjustment to the way I thought I would live my life, but I have just been so blessed, and I have had so many people who have cared about me and who have loved me and who have prayed for me. I don't mind.
Well, how did your husband feel about your decision to write the book?
Well, I had made the decision before I got married to write a book, so he has been supportive, but I didn't talk to him about writing it because I'd already made that decision.
The night you were abducted, June 5th, 2002, you were taken from your bed in the early hours of the morning by this man, Brian David Mitchell. He was a homeless preacher. What kind of a preacher was he?
Well, it's hard to explain Brian David Mitchell. That's what he would have you believe. But really, he loved power and he loved control and he loved being able to manipulate people. And he found that the best way of doing that was by perverting religion, by using it as a means to an end to get what he wanted. I mean, that's how he justified the way he lived, what he did, and that's how he preyed upon other people.
He'd done odd jobs for your parents. Do you think he sought out work for your family specifically so that he could learn the layout of your house in order to kidnap you?
Yes. Yes, he did.
And you were 14 years old when he woke you up, forced you from your bed and out of your home at knife point. Just to give our listeners an idea of how young you were, weren't you supposed to graduate from middle school the following day?
Yes, I was. And even as far as 14-year-olds go, I mean, I was a young 14-year-old.
Not a 14-year-old in New York. You were a 14-year-old in Salt Lake City?
I mean, even that, I was I was so shy. I was scared to talk to boys. I mean, I was scared to... I was just a very shy, quiet kind of person.
And you write that at the time you still thought of yourself as a child. You'd been raised as one of six children in an observant Mormon home where premarital sex, alcohol, drug use were strictly forbidden. So you'd been fairly sheltered.
Yes. Yes, that would be a fair statement.
You said that you didn't try to resist Mitchell or scream for help because he said he'd kill you and kill your family if you made any noise. Can you still remember how terrified you felt that night?
Yes. I had grown up with a very happy childhood. I mean, as far as fear went, I mean, my greatest fear was not playing well at my harp lesson or not doing well on an assignment. So that night that I was kidnapped, the kidnapping, having Brian David Mitchell standing above my bed, holding a knife to my neck, brought a whole new meaning to fear.
You had met him before. How well did you think you knew him?
I'd hardly met him.
He was just a handyman.
Well, hardly even that. I had met him, well, I don't even want to say met. I had seen him when I was downtown shopping with my mom. He had asked her for some work, and he just, I mean, he was clean-shaven. He was cleanly dressed. He just looked like he was out of luck and that maybe he had a family to support. And so when he asked my mom for work and not just money, she's very protective. She doesn't easily invite people to our home, but he just seemed so genuine to her that she said, well, call my husband. He might have work for you. And he called my dad with the sole intention of finding out where I lived, because it was in that moment that he decided I was the one he wanted to kidnap.
Although he had earlier tried to kidnap an adult woman.
Yes.
So this was not just the fact that you were a very good-looking young woman. Or do you think that, because later he also was interested in young women, we'll get to that. Do you think that there was a pedophile side to this story?
Yes. Yes, there was. His whole life during the trial, I watched so many people get up on the stand, and almost every life he's ever touched, he's destroyed. So he found when he couldn't convince mostly this woman to come away with him, he decided that it had to be a young girl because he could control her. He could do whatever he wanted to do to her because she wouldn't be able to fight back. And that's how he decided to go after young girls.
But he had a common law wife, Wanda Barzee. She wasn't a young girl. Why? And they fought all the time. Why do you think she remained under his control? Or remained loyal to him?
Because he told her what she wanted to hear. They had both fallen so far into their facade of deception and lies, it was just easier to continue on with it than to fight back, even if she did know it was wrong. I mean, the worst thing about this whole, I mean, with her, in regards to this whole situation, was that she is a mother herself of six children. How could she be a mother of six kids and allow him to do what he did to me? That's got to be one of the worst parts of this whole story.
Was she there when you had to leave your bedroom?
No, she was waiting for us up at the hidden camp.
And you, your sister had actually been awake, but she was terrified. How long before she told your parents?
She was just a little girl.
And 9 years old?
Yeah, very little. And there's always been some kind of confusion as to how long she waited to tell my parents. So I don't know that I've ever quite been clear on that, but I believe it was about an hour.
And then you had to hike in the dark in your pajamas?
Yes.
How far? To a mountain behind your house?
Yes. Many people have always thought, oh, well, you were practically in your own backyard. How could you not run? How could you not escape? But unless you have been to that camp, you have no idea how difficult it is to get there. It is not easy. It is very, very rocky, very, very steep. You are practically breaking a trail through a wall of trees. It is not an easy hike.
Do you feel that people often judge you? I mean, here you were, a very young, as you point out, 14-year-old, without all that much experience in life beyond your life with your parents and your school, the kind of things that they may have expected you to do might not have occurred to someone like you. The reason I ask is recently talked to the young woman who had been raped by Roman Polanski when she was, I think, 16. Maybe she was your age, in fact, 14 at that time. And people judged her harshly. She was a child.
It's wrong for anyone to judge a victim or a survivor because nobody else knows what they went through and what the circumstances were. But for me personally, I mean, I have seen the very worst of humanity, but I've also seen the very best. And I have to say, the majority of people that I've met or I've come across, they only have the best of intentions and they really do care. There'll always be the few people that don't agree, but you can never please everybody.
My guest is Elizabeth Smart, who has written a memoir called My Story with Chris Stewart. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We'll be back with more right after this. And we are back with Elizabeth Smart, who has written with the help of Chris Stewart a memoir called My Story. It is published by St. Martin's Press. I mentioned earlier that a number of books have also been written about your story, a number of them from your family members. Now, did you learn things from them about their perspective of this story that you were surprised by?
Yes, I did. I mean, because I was gone, because I was kidnapped, I didn't know my parents' side of the story. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
And you weren't aware? There were no newspapers or anything that you came across that mentioned the kidnapping?
I was hidden away for the first 6 weeks. And during those first 6 weeks, Mitchell brought back a poster of me. And he brought back one newspaper clipping that was a picture of me and had all these piranha bites taken out of it. And it was not a negative article, but not a positive one either, just saying how Elizabeth Smart became a household name.
He claimed to be a prophet. Didn't he tell you he was carrying out God's will by kidnapping you and then later forcing you to drink alcohol and smoke? The sorts of things that most religious people disapprove of.
Yes, and he told me I should be grateful for it because he was helping me to descend below all things so that one day I could rise above all these things.
And that was his justification for raping you as well?
Well, he didn't see it as rape. He saw it as a sexual relationship between a man and a wife.
Even though he already had Wanda Barzee?
Yes. Yes.
You've written that you felt shattered the first time Mitchell raped you and then left you alone and bleeding on the floor of the tent that the three of you were sharing. Because of your Mormon background, weren't you convinced, at least at first, that having been raped would make you worthless and an outcast?
I did feel worthless. I did feel like I could never be loved again, like I wasn't a human. But it was almost immediately after that I realized that my family would always love me, that could never be changed. They'd always be my family, and they'd always love me. They'd always want me back. And so with that realization, I was able to make the decision to survive no matter what. I'd do whatever it took because they'd love me, and that would be enough.
In speaking to young women who you say come up to you when you do motivational speaking, do they tell you similar stories, or do they feel that they had been abandoned?
I have heard many similar stories, and it breaks my heart when I hear it, but at the same time, it also makes me feel like what I am doing is so worthwhile because there are so many women and men and children who are raped and sexually abused all the time.
So he didn't see this as rape. He saw this as normal, a sexual relationship.
Yes.
And so it continued.
Yes.
The camp where you were in was in a remote area of the mountain that wasn't accessible to any established trails. They had you tied to a tree with a 20-foot-long cable.
Yeah, it was just long enough for me to lie down inside the tent and walk outside a few feet away where there was a bucket that was used as a bathroom that I was able to use.
Could you yell help?
That was my world. I remember one morning, very, very near to the beginning when I was first kidnapped, I remember hearing someone calling my name, and I wanted to yell back so bad. But as soon as my two captors heard this person yelling, they immediately came running over to me. Well, I wasn't really that far. I was maybe a couple feet away. And they just grabbed hold of me. And I remember just Mitchell looking at me and saying, "If you scream out, we will kill you. And we will kill anybody who comes here and tries to rescue you." And who was to say they weren't going to kill me?
And that's a lot of pressure to put on a 14-year-old kid.
Yeah.
There were also search helicopters that flew directly overhead, but they couldn't see you.
Yeah, I remember. I just imagined when the helicopters would fly overhead that all of a sudden men would come rappelling out of helicopters with ropes and they'd be in their full body combat clothing and they'd rescue me. They'd surround us and we'd just be outnumbered and I'd be rescued. And every time that helicopter would fly away or just move off, I just feel heartbroken.
I get the feeling from what you've written here that you find it quite frustrating to be asked why you didn't try harder to escape during the first few hours after you've been kidnapped, or even later after several months had passed and your captors allowed you a little more freedom. Is it your feeling that people who ask those kinds of questions have forgotten how young and how terrified you were at the time?
Well, I think those people just, for me, I just don't think they realize what the situation was. I mean, I was very young, and I was very heavily threatened. But at the same time, I did try to escape a couple times. They weren't successful, but I did try. But I eventually got to a point where it wasn't just about the immediate escape. It was overall being rescued and not taking a chance with my life or my family's life. And I waited until the right moment. I waited until I felt like there was a sure possibility that I would be able to get away, which came when we were in California and they were discussing where we should go. And I was able to convince Mitchell and Barzi to go back to Salt Lake. And that's what eventually led to my rescue.
Well, there are people who have suggested that you didn't try harder to escape because you developed a fondness for your captors known as the Stockholm Syndrome. They said the same thing about Patricia Hearst. They said the same thing about these poor women who had been held captive in Cleveland. I'm sure you followed that story as well. You categorically deny that.
I never suffered from Stockholm Syndrome.
You never thought
syndrome.
That they were family.
No, no. They did not love me. They did not take care of me. They did not. They hurt me. They made me feel terrible.
But they did try, and both of them, to break your links with your family. They didn't call you Elizabeth.
They stripped me from everything that I knew and loved, even my identity.
What was the significance of the name that they gave you? Shear J. Shub. That's the name of Isaiah's son in the Bible, wasn't it?
Yes. And I was told that the meaning was a remnant would return. And they said they gave it to me because I would one day return to my family, but I would be standing next to them and I would be calling my family to repentance alongside them.
Which, because he was a true prophet of God.
Yes, so he claimed.
Did Mitchell and Barzi use biblical names as well?
They did. They did. They had gone through a progression of names, really. And eventually they had ended up with Mitchell called himself Emmanuel, meaning God is with us. And Barzi eventually ended up with the name Hephzibah, meaning my delight is in thee.
Mitchell told you that you were just one of seven wives he planned to take. Didn't you learn later that he had tried unsuccessfully to abduct this adult woman before he kidnapped you, and then he tried to kidnap two other girls. One of them was your cousin.
Yes.
And were you brought along during these attempts?
No, I was still hidden away.
And what prevented him from being successful?
Generally, they were small things. When he tried to kidnap my cousin, on her windowsill, she has a lot of glass figurines or small vases with dried flowers, books. I mean, the kinds of things you'd expect to find in a girl's room. And he'd cut the screen and he was moving the blinds to get in. And these figurines and these trinkets would came crashing off the windowsill onto the floor. And it woke up her father down the hall, and he came running into the bedroom. And once there was a second crash, the second time he tried to get in there, and there was a big crash, which is really when my uncle came running down the hall, that was when he knew that he could not kidnap her. He had to get away.
But both of the other girls he tried to abduct were also Mormons. You think he targeted Mormons because he assumed that they were virgins, or because there's a history of polygamy within the church?
That's a really good question.
I mean, do you think he saw himself as being some kind of fundamentalist Mormon?
No, he did not. He may have targeted Mormon girls because they were virgins, but just more than that, he targeted them because he thought they would be more malleable than other young girls.
Now, you also, beyond all the things we've been talking about, you were hungry a lot, weren't you? Cold and hungry and thirsty?
Yes.
How did he get food? Was he foraging all the time?
He stole. He stole what he wanted. He'd call it plundering. And I remember I asked him, I was like, well, what's the difference between stealing and plundering? He said, well, when God tells you to take something, when you're taking it for the Lord's purposes, that's plundering. And so he called it plundering. To me, that's stealing.
You said that the three constants during your captivity were hunger, boredom, and rape. That sounds like just a miserable life. The weather got cold, so he decided to take you to San Diego where it'd be warmer?
Yes.
How did you get from Utah to California?
We took the bus.
And where did you live there? Again, outside in a tent?
We were outside. We were in this, for the first few months, we were in this terrible, dried up, sandy riverbed. And I can only describe it as it looked like the fire swamp from Princess Bride. That's what it looked like. I mean, anytime you touched a tree, there are all these millions of little brown things that would fall off. There was no color. It was all just brown and scary back there.
Then you said that you realized after a while that your chances of being rescued would be much better in Utah than California. How were you able to convince Mitchell and Barzi to move back?
I had watched how they had manipulated everybody else around them, how they'd gotten away with what they wanted. And the one common factor in all of these manipulatings was that they used religion. And I knew I couldn't just go up to them and say, oh, well, I think we should go to Salt Lake. I think that sounds like a really good plan because my vote wouldn't be counted. So I thought about it, and I knew how much he liked to have control of every situation. So I remember I went up to him and I said, oh, I just have this feeling like we're supposed to go back to Salt Lake. I know that sounds so crazy because God would never speak to me, but I know he'll speak to you. I know he'll answer you because you're his servant. Could you ask God if we're supposed to go back to Salt Lake? And he did.
You're playing up to his ego.
Yes.
It's also where the girls were. I'm sure that was in the back of his head. And then you were recognized on the street soon after your ride back?
Yes, I remember we were walking up State Street when all of a sudden just police car after police car pulled up and they all jumped out and surrounded us.
One of the reasons you didn't write this book sooner is that you wanted you had to wait until their trials were finished?
that's not really a reason why I wrote the book. I guess it could have been, but it really wasn't, because I never thought I would write a book. And it really was after the trial that took place, where so many facts came out and so much was said, and I never felt like I was able to give it context. I never felt like I was able to say what it meant to me and what was going through me. And then top that with all the speaking and all the experiences I've had with other survivors, that's kind of what really led me to write this book.
What happened to them? What were the verdicts of the court? They had two different trials.
Yes. Mitchell will spend life in prison, and Barzi, she will spend, I can't remember the exact amount of years, but she's only got, I think, 5 or 6 more years in the federal courts, and then she'll come back to face state charges.
Did you ever speak to her about what she was thinking?
No, and I really...
I mean, how can you allow him to do this to me?
Oh, while I was kidnapped.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. And she would just come back to me and say, it's the Lord's commandment. It's what God has commanded for us, and it's hard, but it's what we're supposed to do.
Where were her kids?
They'd all grown up or moved out, had moved on with their life and left her behind.
And now, do you think you're going to write any more books?
I don't know if I will.
Meanwhile, Elizabeth Smart will be at the Barnes & Noble store at 86th Street and Lexington Avenue tonight at 7 o'clock signing books. And then she'll be speaking with the Hudson Union Society tomorrow at 7 p.m. That's at the Cornell Club at 6 East 44th Street. For more information and tickets, go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, My Story, is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
On tomorrow's show, investigative lawyer Terry Lenzner looks back at his varied career, investigating the 1964 deaths of 3 civil rights workers, the circumstances of Princess Diana's death, also his work for the Senate Watergate Committee, and his role in the Clinton impeachment fight. Then we'll look at the role that German women played in the Holocaust. Susan Purfar and Hallie Pfeiffer talk about starring in Ethan Coen's new off-Broadway play, Women or Nothing, and our gurus of how to, Al and Larry Abell, take your calls and questions on home repair and how to prepare your home for the cooler weather. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Julia Corcoran, Jessica Miller, and Fanny Cohen. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Victoria Washington was at the audio controls, and we had help today from Janet Bryan, Todd McGovern, and contributing producers Barbara Kahn and Virginia Doris. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.